Good evening. I'm Judy Woodruff on the NewsHour tonight. The end of Roe. Legal challenges to state abortion laws move forward nationwide in the wake of the Supreme Court decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. Then, crackdown. China's president visits Hong Kong to celebrate the anniversary of the end of British rule and consolidate control over the city.
He's telling the people of Hong Kong that the central government cares about Hong Kong. He's also telling the officials here to implement this new central government agenda.
And it's Friday. David Brooks and Ruth Marcus weigh in on the Supreme Court's history-making term, the battle for abortion rights, and the revelations from the January 6th hearings. All that and more on tonight's PBS NewsHour. A barrage of Russian missiles pounded a quiet coastal town in southern Ukraine today, killing at least 21 people, including two children. It happened in the early morning hours, about 50 miles from the port city of Odessa, far from any front line. The shelling battered a nine-story apartment building and a resort as residents slept. Rescue workers scoured the rubble for human remains with the help of locals.
We heard the strikes. We live close by. We came here to the site, and together with emergency workers, we helped those who survived. And those who unfortunately died, we helped to carry them away.
The Kremlin again falsely denied that it targets civilian areas. Meanwhile, in Russia, the trial for U.S. women's basketball star Brittany Griner got underway in a Moscow suburb 4.5 months after she was arrested for possessing cannabis oil. Griner entered the courtroom in handcuffs. She has been charged with intentionally importing narcotics into Russia. A U.S. diplomat spoke to reporters after attending the opening session.
I did have the opportunity to speak with Ms. Griner in the courtroom. She is doing as well as can be expected in these difficult circumstances. And she asked me to convey that she is in good spirits and is keeping up the faith.
If convicted, Griner could face up to 10 years in prison. Today, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken tweeted that he has no higher priority than bringing her and other wrongfully detained Americans home. It's been 25 years since Britain returned Hong Kong to Chinese rule, and China's leader Xi Jinping used the anniversary to defend his vision. In a speech, he emphasized the one country, two systems framework for the former British colony, now under Beijing's control. And he also rejected claims that China is curtailing its political and civic freedoms. We'll have more on all this later in the program. At least 19 people in northeastern India have died in mudslides triggered by weeks of torrential rain. Soldiers joined the rescue effort to find dozens still missing. Many were swept away in a sea of mud. This year's monsoon season has caused unusually heavy downpours, leaving hundreds of thousands of residents there homeless. A new tropical storm formed over the Caribbean today as it barreled toward Central America. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said Tropical Storm Bonnie is on track to hit the Nicaragua-Costa Rica border region, bringing 40-mile-an-hour winds and up to 8 inches of rain. It is projected to intensify and cause significant flooding over the weekend. Monkeypox cases across Europe have tripled over the past 2 weeks. That is according to the World Health Organization, which called today for urgent action to reverse the spread. Europe now accounts for about 90% of the more than 5,000 monkeypox infections worldwide. In economic news across the Atlantic, inflation hit a record high last month. For the 19 countries that use the euro currency, it rose to 8.6% in June, the highest level of inflation there since record-keeping for the euro began in 1997. The surge was driven by a spike in energy costs, fueled in part by Russia's invasion of Ukraine. And on Wall Street today, stocks started the new month on a higher note. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 322 points to close at 31,097. The NASDAQ rose 99 points, and the S&P 500 added 40. Still to come on the NewsHour, weather forecasters increasingly address climate change in their daily reports. Supply chain issues put a damper on plans for July 4th fireworks. Several members of the NewsHour staff discuss new books they've written, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington, and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
When the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade, the battle over abortion rights shifted to the state level. Now, abortion services are banned completely in seven states, and bans will soon go into effect in four others with so-called trigger laws. President Biden, in a meeting with nine Democratic governors this afternoon to discuss all this, said, quote, "I think people are going to be shocked when the first state tries to arrest a woman for crossing a state line to get health services. I don't think people believe that's going to happen, but it's going to happen." Legal battles over state laws have already begun. Courts placed bans in three states on hold this week. And in some states, abortion providers have been left confused over conflicting laws and shifting guidance from leaders. Joining me now to discuss the nation's new patchwork of laws is Carrie Franklin. She is the faculty director of the Center on Reproductive Health, Law, and Policy at the UCLA School of Law. Professor Carrie Franklin, welcome to the NewsHour. I think a number of people look at what they think may happen after Roe v. Wade being overturned. They think of the coasts of the country largely being open to abortion, but the middle of the country and the South not. Is that roughly what the country is going to look like now?
That appears to be how it will look. We're seeing Roe pull the red states and blue states further apart in the sense that the response, as we knew in the anti-abortion states, would be to enact more legislation and more restrictions, but also in the reproductive freedom states, the blue states, we're seeing a lot of lawmaking as well to amplify protections and to increase funding for care. So where you live in this country is extremely determinative of your rights and will be even more so going forward.
Well, within these states that have conservative Republican leadership in the governor's office and the legislatures, the states, many of which have these trigger laws, where abortion bans were to go into effect. We now see, as we mentioned, challenges in three of them, Kentucky, Louisiana, Utah. What do you see unfolding in these states?
I think it remains to be seen. I would describe the situation nationwide now as chaotic. We see laws going into effect. We see laws being enjoined. We see clinics canceling appointments and then calling people and rescheduling these appointments. I think judges are scrambling to try to figure out. Some states have old laws that they're trying to bring into effect. Are those laws antiquated? Have they been superseded by new laws? Do these new trigger laws comport with state constitutions? Because what happened on Friday is the Supreme Court said the United States Constitution doesn't protect your right to abortion. But now we have 50 other constitutions under which we're going to have to decide what rights are available. A lot of these constitutions have protections for privacy, for liberty, for equal protection, and we're going to have to work out on the state level exactly what the state constitutions afford.
And then you have the states, Professor Franklin, with a Democratic governor, Democratic state legislature, states that are going to be seeking to protect women's access to abortion. What do you see unfolding there in terms of challenges?
I see a lot of laws being passed in terms of increasing funding, in terms of increasing the number of providers. I think some of the challenges will involve blue states trying to insulate providers and those who help people seeking care from attempts by anti-abortion states to reach across borders. So states like California and New York, Connecticut, Massachusetts are passing laws saying, we're not going to use our state courts, our state law enforcement to extradite people or to enforce your judgments when they are contrary to our constitutions and our deepest legal commitments.
And I do want to also ask you about what President Biden said today, that he's going to be on the lookout, that we all should be on the lookout for states that essentially are going to be going after women who try to cross a state line to get an abortion. What do you see happening in that regard?
The law is very unclear in this regard. I think there was a very important signal in the Dobbs decision on Friday when Justice Kavanaugh said, if a state tried to ban an abortion seeker from leaving a state to get care, that would, he said, clearly violate the constitutional right to travel, signaling that some of the justices who were willing to overturn Roe might think there are some limits on how much red states can try to extend their laws to conduct that happens beyond their borders. I will just say there has been commentary from the right for a long time that overruling Roe would get the courts out of the abortion umpiring business. And I do not think that will happen. Roe is overturned and we are seeing a flood of lawsuits and will for many years over these very difficult questions of conflicts of laws, states trying to apply laws outside their borders, and a lot of messy and complicated legal questions coming our way.
And with regard to some of those messy and complicated legal questions, what about any laws with regard to medication-induced abortions, which we now know constitute over half the abortions in this country?
I think that will be a big area of litigation going forward. The FDA has found medication and abortion to be safe and efficacious up to 10 weeks. There's a possibility that the FDA determinations that these medications are safe may preempt some state restrictions that go beyond what the FDA has said is necessary. I do think medication abortion will be a big part of the puzzle. I think we'll see a lot of lawsuits about it, and only time will tell how strong the FDA's rulings about the safety of this medication are in states that are trying to restrict it.
And finally, I know you were telling us you are also looking at the effect all of this could have on women's access to health care, broadly speaking.
Yeah, I am seeing some reports that doctors, providers, and pharmacists have been hesitant to prescribe or fill prescriptions for drugs such as methotrexate, which are involved in treating ectopic pregnancies, for misoprostol, which are involved in miscarriage care, but are also used in medication abortion. And some of these laws are so broad and vague that providers are afraid that even if they're treating ectopic pregnancies and miscarriages, overzealous prosecutors may come after them. And we're seeing doctors already pulling back from care. And I think there's a real concern that this new regime will affect not just people seeking abortion, but may deleteriously affect the health of lots of women and pregnant people.
Well, what I hear you saying, among other things, is we are looking at a lack of clarity for some time to come. Professor Carrie Franklin at the UCLA School of Law, we thank you.
Happy to be here.
China's President Xi Jinping visited Hong Kong, as we reported, to lead official celebrations for the 25th anniversary of the territory's handover from Britain to China. Over the last 3 years, Beijing has cracked down on Hong Kong's once vibrant political scene amid global criticism. Hong Kong's authorities now say it marks the start of a brighter future for the city after years of social unrest and COVID-19 challenges. But many locals say it highlights how much Hong Kong has changed for the worse. Special correspondent Richard Kimber sent this report on how the day's celebrations are leaving the city divided.
A fanfare and a flyover to consolidate Hong Kong's future under Chinese rule. Presiding over it all, the man in charge.
After experiencing ups and downs, everyone can painfully feel that Hong Kong cannot be chaotic and must not become chaotic again. I feel more deeply that the development of Hong Kong cannot be delayed any longer. We must eliminate all interference and concentrate on development.
It's the first time President Xi Jinping has left the Chinese mainland since the start of the COVID-19 pandemic. It was a short journey, but symbolically huge.
I think he's telling the people of Hong Kong that the central government cares about Hong Kong. He's also telling the officials here to implement this new central government agenda.
Top of that agenda, announcing that the one country, two systems policy of governing Hong Kong will stay in place, and inaugurating Hong Kong's former security chief as the city's new leader.
With the enactment and implementation of the National Security Law, Hong Kong has been able to restore order from chaos, and the improvement of the electoral system has enabled the implementation of the principle of patriots administering Hong Kong.
Li was the only candidate in the chief executive race and was voted in by a committee stacked with pro-China loyalists. He'll take charge of a legislature with almost no political opposition after Beijing imposed sweeping changes after months of anti-government protests in Hong Kong in 2019. Widespread arrests of democracy activists followed, then the introduction of a controversial national security law and increasing social division.
I think we have seen this story before when Hong Kong first handed over. So for some, it is a period of from instability to stability, looking forward to the brighter future. For others, it's still a sense of foreboding.
The government says that stability will bring prosperity and opportunity for all. That's being welcomed by many in the business community, but not everyone shares that optimism. The recent political changes have become too much to bear for many families. Though they've never been to the United Kingdom before, this family will emigrate there in a few weeks. They wanted to remain anonymous for this report.
Everything we have, family, friends, and work, are all here. It took a lot of struggle to make this decision.
One concern is their son's education. Officials in Beijing have blamed Hong Kong schools for fostering dissent among students. Under new rules, children must take classes on national security and sing China's national anthem to mark important holidays. New textbooks will claim that Hong Kong was never a British colony, regardless of the history, and that the protest movements were caused by foreign forces.
I studied in Hong Kong myself, and what is happening now is that the authorities have changed everything we learned in the past into something new. They only teach you what they want you to know. It's brainwashing the kids. They won't teach you the real history.
Almost 100,000 Hong Kong residents left here in 2020. Many took advantage of citizenship programs offered in response to Beijing's political reforms. That's led to concerns about a brain drain in the city. But local pro-government groups say there's nothing to worry about.
Some people are not happy here. They move. They just go on, go to other countries. It means the less conflict in Hong Kong. So you make everybody happier and more stable and more focused on making our life better in Hong Kong. So it's not a bad thing. I think it's good for everybody.
But that's not the only reason Hong Kong is facing a potential exodus. International finance groups say that the government's insistence on maintaining strict COVID-19 policies, including mandatory hotel quarantine for new arrivals into the city, is making the process of doing international business here increasingly difficult. A survey from the American Chamber of Commerce found that more than half its business leader members were considering leaving Hong Kong because of the COVID rules. Hong Kong's new leader, John Lee, says he's working on a strategy to reopen the borders, but there are concerns that China's own zero COVID policy will mean he won't have the power to call the shots.
He has very little autonomy. John Lee is the creature of the central government when it comes to this. He's highly dependent on the central government for other things as well. But on this, on the COVID thing, I think he will take orders from the central government.
The Beijing government says the best way to solve Hong Kong's problems is for the public to remain united under Chinese rule. But while the anniversary festivities continue in this once freewheeling metropolis, some Hong Kongers are still wondering what exactly they should be celebrating. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Richard Kimber in Hong Kong.
Even before this summer began, there were extreme heat waves and new heat records throughout the Northern Hemisphere. Extreme heat took a heavy toll in the U.S., Europe, Russia, Japan, and China. India and Pakistan endured blistering conditions this spring, leading to a loss of life, and the forecast calls for a hotter-than-normal summer in much of the U.S. Scientists say climate change is accelerating and intensifying these kind of heat waves. It's taken a while for some TV weathermen and women to make these connections. But that's changing, apparently. Science correspondent Miles O'Brien has the story.
We look at climate and how it affects our weather. Now, climate specialist Jeff Berardelli.
It's a little past five in Tampa, and Jeff Berardelli's climate classroom is on the air.
There's new research into how hurricanes are changing in a warmer world.
He is the chief meteorologist and climate specialist at WFLA. And at least twice a week, he makes important connections for his viewers between local weather and the global climate emergency.
I do what any good newsman like yourself would do. I look for a hook.
Unfortunately, the hooks are easier and easier to find. Record heat waves and historic flooding, droughts, wildfires, and tropical storms all becoming more numerous and gaining strength. Plenty of grist for the mill.
Well, the world's on fire right now. We got a lot of problems. We are trying to save the world. I mean, that's essentially what we're doing by educating people on climate change.
Times sure have changed.
Good evening on a dry and delightful kind of night.
This was the weatherman I grew up with in Detroit.
Combination of cloudy and chilly, clearly kind of weather is what it is.
But that was then.
Meteorologists are in a key place. We're scientists, we're a trusted messenger of information in local markets, and we're good communicators, and we have a platform. Put all that together, and there seems to be no one better than a local meteorologist to tell the story of climate change.
With more than 40 years of experience as a TV weather forecaster, NBC's Al Roker has lived the transition.
You're really a very trusted source in people's living rooms. You're probably the only scientist they've ever seen at any level.
Isn't that sad? What kind of a world are we living in when I'm the trusted source?
All kidding aside, today he too explains the climate science behind the weather whenever he sees a hook.
90 plus days, five more per year for Portland. So we're watching climate change make things hotter in the Pacific Northwest.
Like the climate, the change has been gradual. In 1997, Roker joined several other meteorologists at the White House for a summit of sorts.
I hope you will think about how your work has been affected by what we believe is going on in the climate.
President Clinton and Vice President Gore urged them all to use some of their airtime to educate Americans about climate change, but nothing came of it.
Try to explain for me the reluctance of meteorologists in general to tackle this issue early on.
I would argue that it wasn't so much meteorologists as it was probably news directors who felt, oh, nobody cares. It was like, you know, putting in broccoli in the mac and cheese.
And collectively, TV meteorologists were diehard climate deniers for a long time.
My frustration is that the national media never seems to question the global warming scare.
As late as 2010, a George Mason University poll showed 54% of them were not convinced the climate was changing.
There was still a lot of misinformation in the world about, well, there still is a lot of misinformation in the world about climate change.
Bernadette Woods Plackey is a former local TV meteorologist, now with Climate Central, a nonprofit focused on science communication.
As the science evolved, and the people who were already in these roles as TV meteorologists were evolving also, they were trying to keep up with the science, but they were also being really hit with the misinformation campaigns.
Meanwhile, the evidence became much harder to deny. When Superstorm Sandy hit the New York City area in 2012, the atmosphere changed.
I think people were just blown away by how this system behaved and what it did. Most people are looking at this and going, what the heck's going on here? And looking for answers. And the answers are, by and large, climate change.
At about the same time, Climate Central and George Mason University developed a service called Climate Matters. It provides TV meteorologists a weekly package featuring the latest vetted climate science, along with broadcast-ready graphics. Jeff Berardelli is one of about 1,100 TV forecasters now using Climate Matters content.
We have a choice to how much warmer we get, and that depends on how inflated we let greenhouse gases get.
I do think that Climate Matters had a role in changing where the TV meteorology community was, bringing them along, helping them understand the connections between weather and climate change, and helping them inform their communities. The needle has been moved in the TV meteorology community. It absolutely has.
In fact, the latest George Mason poll, conducted in 2017, shows 95% of weathercasters now agree the climate emergency is happening. The science makes it untenable to conclude anything else. Amy Fries is a meteorologist at Fox Weather.
I mean, just kind of this mind-blowing explosion of information is out there that lets us know a lot more about what's happening. And so that, right there in itself, being better at science and meteorology, then has brought on the added responsibility of talking about climate.
But on her sister network, Fox News, the climate denial persists.
The science is not settled. We can all agree that the climate is warming, temperatures are going up, but we are not sure why.
Still, Fries says her bosses have not asked her to pull her climate punches.
Just out, a new federal report analyzing the impact for up to a foot of sea level rise over the next 30 years.
No, I don't feel any pressure to do anything other than give people the forecast and have great conversations about what's happening with our climate. I've never felt uncomfortable at all.
Jeff Berardelli says his viewers are very interested in climate stories, especially the younger ones, a demographic local stations covet.
If we are going to make positive change in this world, we have to start doing it soon. Politics hasn't followed suit yet. You can only hope that you keep telling the truth and that people see this stuff unfolding in front of them and that things do eventually change.
The public is finally hearing about climate research from scientists they know and trust. But will that lead to political action to address the crisis? That one is hard to forecast. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Miles O'Brien in Tampa.
It has been a remarkable and busy week here in Washington. The Supreme Court capped off a consequential term, even as the fallout continues from last Friday's decision to overturn Roe v. Wade. And there was a surprise hearing of the January 6th Congressional Committee to present testimony from inside former President Trump's inner circle. All that brings us to the analysis of Brooks and Marcus. That's New York Times columnist David Brooks and Ruth Marcus, deputy editorial page editor for The Washington Post. Jonathan Capehart is away. Hello to both of you. Welcome, Ruth. Welcome back, David, from your well-deserved time trying to do something. I'm sure it was civilized and let's hope relaxing. So let's talk about this Supreme Court term. David, whether you liked it, loved it, or you hated what they did, it's been historic. How do you size it?
Certainly epical. I guess I'll focus on the regulatory stuff, the abortion stuff we can also talk about. But in a series of decisions involving OSHA, involving the EPA most recently, involving the CDC, the Supreme Court took power away from agencies and said, no, Congress has to deal with this. And arguing that the agencies had overstepped their congressional mandate. And I have a lot of sympathy in theory for the idea that as much as possible should be decided in legislatures and not by unelected representatives. The problem for us right now is that we have a broken Congress. And so if it's not going to be settled in an agency, it's probably not going to be settled at all. And that's especially true for climate change. And so I'm afraid our political dysfunction sort of undermines what I think is a very sound principle that the court should be pushing back at overreach by agencies.
So pushing it at a time when agencies are not so, when our legislatures are not so.
Right. And one of the things I've learned covering, in political science, they say people want power. My career has taught me people don't want power. Congress loves to send power over to the agency so they don't have to take responsibility for anything. So we've got this weird thing where the Congress doesn't want to do anything. The agencies now are being permitted or not being permitted to do anything.
How do you size up this term?
Well, this term was blockbuster is not a strong enough word for what this term was. And I'd love to talk about administrative law till the cows come home. But it's so much bigger than that. And it really underscored the huge difference between six and five. Six conservative justices can do whatever they want because they have a justice to spare and still keep the majority. And so they did this term. They got rid of the right to abortion. They expanded the right to the Second Amendment right. They further dismantled to the point where you can hardly see it, the wall of separation between church and state. And they really did change the regulatory landscape such that, from my point of view, just to argue with you a bit, Congress can't now delegate and say, you guys are the experts, fix this problem. But now they're requiring Congress, which means that, as you say, no one can get things done.
So, I mean, what about this notion, David, that it was blockbuster, that it changed things in a way that we haven't seen in decades?
Yeah, well, absolutely. If you look, I saw a graph today of how many decisions of the court over the decades were conservative, and it's like, it's a little like this, and then this year comes along and it's way up in the ceiling. And so there clearly was really the culmination of a 50-year development of the Federalist Society, all this stuff. They now control the court. And the one thing that's peeved me a little, and Ruth is going to argue with me about this, is that... I've heard some argument that, you know, we had all these decades of liberal decisions, and now suddenly we get conservative decisions, and suddenly politics is entering the court. And to me, that's not true. There was liberal decisions for a while, and now there's very strong conservative decisions.
Is that what's happened?
Well, now there are very strong conservative decisions reached in ways that I would argue are deeply unconservative, without due regard for the importance of keeping to precedent, cherry-picking history when it suits your purpose and ignoring it when it doesn't. Justice Kagan in the regulatory decision that you were citing said, we're all textualists now, except when it doesn't suit us. And in that case, we just read words out of statutes. So I have problems not just with the outcome, but with the way they did it. But there's one other really important point. This term was the culmination of this battle for conservative control, but it wasn't the end of it. Next term also looks to be shaping up to be a blockbuster. We're going to see, I think, the end of affirmative action in higher education. We're going to see religious freedom, religious liberty prioritized over gay rights. We're going to see the further shredding of the Voting Rights Act. Just buckle up.
There's a big decision coming on redistricting at the state level. So, David, you said setting aside abortion for a moment. I mean, it's the big one out right. there. It's
right. Other than that, how'd you like the
other term? Than that, right, exactly. Right. The repercussions are coming by the day. We talked about it at the beginning of the program. The states are now trying to figure out what in the world are they going to do. What about the political repercussions of this? I mean, how do you see it changing the landscape?
I don't know. That's what's interesting to me, because opinion on abortion has been astonishingly stable for decades. And now suddenly this happens, and as we heard earlier in the program, it's just going to be a period of intense flux. And new things are going to happen. Joe Biden's comment earlier that people are going to watch a woman get arrested for crossing state lines. That is absolutely going to be shocking to people. Because most people are sort of in the middle on abortion. But when they see that, they think, what the heck is going on here? And so I think that and all the legal and all the tussling we're going to be facing and all the flexibility could have the possibility of shaking up what has been a very stagnant public opinion rule. In political terms, in narrow political terms, it has clearly helped the Democrats. It has clearly motivated voters. If you look at the polls, who do you want to control the next Congress? Before, it was slight Republican, now it's slight Democrat. Whether that be longstanding, I'm not sure, but it's clearly had some mobilizing effect.
You see that the same way?
Some mobilizing effect. I'm a little bit of a skeptic on how much mobilizing effect. For years, it's been clear that Republicans have done a better job of mobilizing their voters on abortion, on single issues like abortion and gun rights, much better on mobilizing them about the courts than Democrats have. But we are in new territory, as you say, David, not just the first woman who's arrested crossing state lines, but the first woman who's prosecuted, women who die because they can't get appropriate care. So, look, if you are Democrats, talking about abortion being on the ballot is a lot better than talking about gas prices being on the ballot or the border being on the ballot or crime being on the ballot. Will that be enough for Democrats to change the tide of what is historically and looks like this year certainly will be a bad midterm outcome? I'm a little doubtful.
Yeah. You're saying you don't think, you don't, you're not sure it's going to stay the issue that it is right now for Democrats.
It may stay, but it might not be the motivating force. And of course, there are still motivations on the other side, and it also is a state-by-state issue. So we've all sorted ourselves geographically so that you may turn out to vote in a state where your turnout doesn't matter very much.
But I'm asking you to predict how long, how much staying power does this have?
I agree with Ruth. Limited. I mean, it'll mobilize some voters clearly in some places. Maybe I'm not. Maybe you didn't say
and
that.
And I want to be wrong. Just to be clear.
My feel is the election is going to be about inflation, about the economy. 83% of the country thinks the economy is in bad shape. That's an unprecedented number, and so that's just, I think, going to be the dominant issue. And prices may go up in, you know, July 4th weekend and all that kind of stuff. One other thing that's going to happen as a result of this is the further bifurcation of America into two different countries. Yeah. We're going to have different abortion regimes. Yeah. We may, because of the other Supreme Court decisions, have other more states, different regimes. And so we could be seeing ourselves becoming a country with two different kinds of economies, two different sets of cultural values, and two different sets of governing policies sort of held together by string.
It does divide further. What's already a divided.
It does divide, and to the question of staying power among Democrats, as much as they are energized, they are also frustrated, understandably frustrated, because there's not much they can do now. Lots of pressure on President Biden, do something, do something, do something. Not a lot he can do.
Let's talk about something else equally, shall we say, divisive, the January 6th committee. David, the last time you were on the program, it was early June, you said the committee, I looked it up to just wanted to get the exact David Brooks word. You said the committee was fundamentally ill-pointed, that it that it should have been focused on preventing another one.
Revise my remarks. I mean, the point I was trying to make is we need a committee to focus on the future January 6ths, but what happened this week was, I mean, it's amazing we're talking about the possible indictment of a former president as our third topic. But
when it happens, it'll be the lead.
Yeah, right. And so this is, you know, what we really saw, something I did not think we would see, which was that there really could be a case made against Donald Trump for inciting an insurrection. And what we saw today, and to me, the crucial of Cassidy Hutchinson's comments, the crucial one, was take out the magnetometers, take out the metal detectors. That is clearly a guy who knows there's violence, that there's armed people capable of violence, and he wants to make it easy for them. That's a pretty, if the other people testify that he said that, that's a pretty damning thing.
Very damning, and I think it's always been critical that we look both forward to prevent another January 6th, but also backward to find out what precisely went on, not just that day, though the testimony about that day was riveting, but also in the lead up to that day.
Is it, Ruth, let me stay with you on it, is what the committee is finding going to have a material effect on the former president and what he's, and his political standing? I mean, David's saying he may be in legal jeopardy, but he may also be running for president.
Pretty amazing. He may be in legal jeopardy. The political jeopardy, minds are pretty well made up. There is a core of people who are Trump supporters, Trump true believers, who will not be shaken by anything Cassidy Hutchinson or anybody else has to say. There's a group of Republicans, though, the sort of remaining rational Republicans and Republican-leaning independents who are going to be shaken by this and think, do we need to stick with this guy, or can't we get somebody who's like Trump without all that baggage? And they're increasingly being presented with more options, Ron DeSantis, maybe the governor of Virginia, Glenn Youngkin. And then there's a group of people like me who watch the hearings who've been extraordinarily squeamish, I still am, about the notion of indicting a former president, this president's chief political opponent. But look at this testimony and say, how can we close our eyes to this?
Yeah. How are you looking at that?
Yeah, I do think there's going to be a lot of Republicans, or at least some, who say, Donald Trump, I support you. Thank you for your service. Let's go to the next chapter. And there was a poll in New Hampshire a couple weeks ago now that Ron DeSantis was leading Donald Trump. That struck me as a significant poll. So I do think it's an excuse for people to say, nice job, Donald. Let's move on. So I do think it weakens his grip on the party a bit.
It does still raise questions about the number of Republicans who are still defending him, who are saying that we don't believe the election was legitimate. We think it's still an open question.
The Republican Party should have more 26-year-old young women who have
25.
Guts. 25.
But what a witness.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, she and she is one of a number of others who could come forward, but who haven't. I mean, we're still waiting to hear Pat Cipollone, the White House former chief of former legal counsel, and others.
Yeah.
We need to hear. There, one of the things that this testimony underscored was the degree to which we need to hear testimony from others, from Mark Meadows, from Pat Cipollone, from some of the members of Congress, from the people who were at the Willard Hotel plotting the insurrection in the days leading up to it. We need to hear that testimony either compelled by the committee or by the Justice Department.
We are waiting to hear from the committee to see what they do when they come back. Ruth Marcus, thank you. David Brooks, thank you.
Thank you.
As we've been watching, problems with the global supply chain have affected now nearly every sector of the economy. Now, Americans preparing to celebrate the 4th of July may find increased prices on the fireworks aisle or their cities canceling fireworks displays altogether. Stephanie Tsai has that story.
The booms of July 4th fireworks have gone bust in many American cities.
So we're not doing fireworks this year, basically due to supply chain issues.
Mayor Corey Woods of Tempe, Arizona, says they realized a few months ago that the city's marquee fireworks extravaganza would be a no-go.
We actually checked with several suppliers, and none of them could actually guarantee that we would have them in time for the show.
Fireworks displays around the country are the latest casualty of a combination of economic problems. With fuel prices skyrocketing, importing fireworks has gotten very expensive, says president of the National Fireworks Association, Steve Hauser.
It honestly costs, in a lot of cases, more to ship the goods here than it does to buy the goods. Okay, so where it used to be that, you know, freight was a percentage or a fraction of the cost of the item, now it's half of the cost of the item or more.
Most professional-grade fireworks come from China, which was until recently still in the grips of pandemic lockdowns. This spring, the American Pyrotechnics Association warned the industry to prepare for a challenging season. Since 2019, shipping costs have risen from $8,000 to $10,000 to nearly $45,000 per shipping container. And across the fireworks industry, overall costs have increased by 35%. And that's as demand for those backyard fireworks, like sparklers and bottle rockets, have increased since the pandemic.
And that huge demand came in while we were still struggling through the international shipping issues. So really, it's kind of a function of demand was exceeding supply. And that's really why they're seeing some empty shelves and also why they're seeing some of those prices go up.
Stephen Pelkey is the CEO of Atlas Pyrovision Entertainment, a family-owned fireworks company in New Hampshire. He says in the last year, he's thought about how to cut transportation costs.
Many of those things are making adjustments for how we deliver our products, how many trucks we use, when we deliver it, coming up with the most cost-effective way of the routing of these trucks so we're not having to consume as much fuel.
Another problem facing Pelkey's business is a shortage of pyrotechnicians.
We lost about 15% of our technicians that were highly qualified that are no longer in this industry.
In Tempe, Arizona, the mayor says even in the absence of fireworks, the show must go on.
We're doing a flume show instead at Tempe Beach Park on July 3rd.
What's a flume?
So a flume is really kind of awesome. It's a sort of display of massive lotus flowers that will float in Tempe Town Lake, and they will shoot flames about 30 feet into the air, sort of accompanied with music.
He says it may even be the start of a new July 4th tradition, but at least this year expects a fraction of the usual crowd to show. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Stephanie Tsai.
If, by chance, you are looking for something good to read this summer, you might start with the books written by our very own NewsHour staff. Three of our colleagues are out now with a memoir, a novel, and a nonfiction book, all in very different styles. Jeffrey Brown spoke with them for our Arts and Culture series, Canvas.
The title is irresistible. You cannot resist me when my hair is in braids. A book of short essays, prose poems, and sketches in which Francis Kai Hua Wong writes of raising multiracial children after a divorce and navigating the current cultural and political climate, especially as an Asian American woman. Wong is based in the greater Detroit area as part of the NewsHour's Communities Initiative, a reporting project to bring undertold stories from around the country.
It's a collection of stories inspired by the wisdom of my multiracial children, the feistiness of my bossy Asian American aunties, and the humor of unreliable suitors. And it's all set against the backdrop of kind of an uncertain political landscape that we've had for the last few years.
Each one of these is a highly personal take, but I can see that you are also exploring your own life in history, in our political and cultural moment.
Some of the stories are, you know, I want to say mundane, everyday stories, like teaching my son how to drive. That's something everyone goes through. But then how do you teach a multiracial boy how to drive the summer after George Floyd is killed? And then having to also deal with teaching him, how do you deal with police? And how do you teach your children about this? How do you teach them to be safe? How do you teach the community about this and help other folks know how do you navigate forward?
You are writing about serious things, but I note that there's always some humor.
When you have a room full of teenage girls sitting around your kitchen table complaining about boys, and you find these, there's a lot of humor and joy in that. But it also connects. So we have the most amazing conversations, and that I try to capture as much as I can. It's inspired by the wisdom of all the people around me.
So who do you see this book as being for?
I think of it as a love letter, to the task of constructing a life, raising children, taking care of elders, finding your identity, finding, creating a home and a community, and finding your place in the world.
Boys Come First is also a story of twists and turns in relationships with plenty of humor. But Aaron Foley has written a novel, his first, about three black queer friends in Detroit, where Foley himself grew up. He's now the senior digital editor for the NewsHour's Communities Initiative.
This is something that is a lifelong dream come true, to just tell a story about my hometown, tell a story about Black identity, queer identity that I hope resonates with folks that live in the intersections of those two things. It's a story about three gay Black men in Detroit that are all at a different crossroads in their life, being in their mid-30s, where, you know, sometimes in Black communities, that's when a lot of pressure starts to hit. And so these three characters are struggling to get to those places with good relationships, getting their careers on track, but also the city of Detroit is changing around them.
And it's important to say that this is a funny book.
You know, a lot of queer literature, too, can be a little bit self-loathing, you know, just kind of wallowing in a particular kind of sadness. I wanted something that was a little bit more joyful, a little bit more funny, something that poked fun at certain elements of queer culture and sexuality, because a lot of my friends, we're out of the closet. We're trying to figure these things out, and we have a lot of fun and a lot of mistakes and a lot of mishaps along the way.
This story that you're telling, as you've described it, of Black queer boys to men, a kind of coming of age, you're familiar with it. I wonder if you felt like it exists much in literature.
If you look at the vast majority of queer fiction, you don't often see Black characters centered. I wrote this so that many of the gay Black men I've known over the years and friends with, acquaintances with, could go to a bookstore and see part of their story. I wanted, you know, three strong Black characters right in the middle.
In We Go High, Nicole Ellis tells true stories of others. She profiles some 30 influential women of color who overcame barriers in their lives or careers. Activists, scientists, cultural, business, and political figures. Nicole is the NewsHour's digital anchor and a correspondent.
The general premise of the book is, you know, focusing on not only the accomplishments of different women around the world of color, but how they got there through the lens of the different types of challenges and adversity that they've had to navigate. It's intended to be the kind of book that, you know, validates the challenging experiences that we all experience and also give you a few of the tools to figure out how to move forward.
And you felt all this personally?
Yeah. I mean, I'm a woman of color who also has to deal with a lot of challenges that sometimes feel unique to myself and to the women that are profiled.
Is there an example you can give us in brief, somebody that stood out for you?
One of the profiles that really stood out for me is Stacey Abrams, because it goes back to her high school days when she was valedictorian of her high school class and was basically turned away at the door for a dinner for high school valedictorians at the governor's mansion. And it follows her journey of being told no and being told she doesn't belong in certain spaces all the way up to her run for governor and how she navigated failing in that instance and is now obviously in the running to run again for that office and having explored different ways to bring more voters to the polls in the meantime.
And when you went through these stories and put them together and went back to look, is there a common thread that comes through?
Perseverance, hands down, perseverance. And I'd also say that something that my grandmother used to say that I also attribute a lot of the idea for this book coming from is coming from a Southern Black family of Southern Afro-Texans, is that success is not a zero-sum equation. You see a lot of these specific instances of women hitting a wall and how they navigate that, you know, stems from a relationship to themselves and to seeing the playing field as big enough for them and for other women like them and not operating from a space of scarcity.
We Go High, Boys Come First, You Cannot Resist Me When My Hair Is in Braids. Congratulations to our NewsHour authors. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown.
Nicole, Aaron, and Francis, so proud of the three of you. Thank you, and congratulations. And on the NewsHour online right now, the rollout of COVID vaccines for children under 5 is well underway. But a recent survey found that pediatricians in rural areas appear less likely to recommend children get the vaccine than doctors in urban areas. We dig into what that means on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And for more analysis of the Supreme Court in this week's explosive January the 6th hearing, join moderator Yamiche Alcindor and her Washington Week panel. That's tonight on PBS. And join us again here tomorrow evening for PBS News Weekend, when we'll explore the legal obstacles to any new federal protections of abortion access. And with that, that is the NewsHour for tonight. I'm Judy Woodruff. Thank you. Please stay safe and have a good 4th of July weekend.